Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 634, September 2022.
Welcome back to The Incomparable. Your regular host, Jason Snell, has overslept. I'm Tony Sindelar, filling in for him. Tonight, today, this morning, whenever you're listening, we are talking about the recent Netflix show, The Sandman. And assembled with me is a panel of lovely, wonderful guests who have watched the show and come prepared to talk about it. Allow me to introduce them in an order that I am choosing right now. First up, it's Shannon Sutterth. Hi, Shannon.
Hola, freakies.
Also joining us, Glenn Fleischman.
Hey there. I don't think I've woken up yet, but I'm still ready for duty.
Next up, it's Dan Morin.
As someone who is very sleep deprived, I feel I'm in a perfect state to talk about this.
Also joining us, Sarah Bickerton.
Oh, given the time in New Zealand, I feel like I'm the most closest to sleep right now.
And the second Sutterth of the panel, two Sutterths, no waiting, Chip Sutterth.
We begin in the podcasting world, which humanity insists on calling the real world.
Does it?
Yeah, really?
Let's give you some spoiler-free overviews of The Sandman before we dive in and take it apart. This is a recent Netflix series based on the, I want to call it legendary comic book from the late 80s, early 90s, written by Neil Gaiman and a rotating series of artists. This is a comic book that has, people have been attempting to adapt this into a film or TV series for 30 years. There was early talk of turning this into something as early as 1991, and here we are in 2022. It has happened. It has been through all kinds of different places. Sometimes Neil Gaiman has been attached, sometimes he is not. He has now basically publicly discussed one adaptation that he basically torpedoed through Skunk Works because he thought it was rubbish, but it has finally come to fruition. I think this is a series that has been much beloved to me as a comics reader and a reader especially of pretty much everything in the Vertigo series in the 90s, for better or worse. And they finally did it. They did it. They put it on Netflix as a 10 or 11, depending on when you started watching a series
Surprise!
Of episodes. So that is The Sandman. I've already divulged that I came to this as an avid fan of the comics, and I would say Neil Gaiman's work in general. What about others? What made you want to seek this out, or was this just a thing you stumbled across?
I was definitely one who had read the comics. Chip actually got me into The Sandman back when we were dating, and I treasured the series, have reread it many times over the years. I don't think I was even aware that Netflix was doing this until like the promotion started. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait, what? Oh, okay. At least it's a TV series, because a movie would never have been enough. I don't know who they thought they were kidding. This pleased me to no end. I feel like they knocked it out of the park. I don't know how much of it, was, of course, Gaiman's patience waiting for the right people to work with, the right right producers and so forth to envision. I don't know how much of it is having done Good Omens and American Gods and had those learning experiences to steer him into better directions. But I just feel like this is possibly, personally, one of the most masterful adaptations I can think of that I've seen going from print to screen.
I'd like to echo exactly what Shannon said, except I wasn't dating Chip, but everything else. It's very accurate. I came to the comic books not when they were first coming out, but with the Absolute editions. I can't remember how I think I discovered Neil Gaiman a little bit later. Like, I read all of his stuff years after he was writing it and then started to read him more contemporaneously. And I found out about Sandman. Maybe I saw like one comic or something, and I was like, oh, a library has the Absolute editions. I'll just get the whole thing, you know, and they weigh, I don't know, like 12 pounds a piece.
A lot.
Yeah, they're very
amazing.
Heavy.
And so I read through all those, and I think I wound up reading them twice, but I have the same reaction Shannon does, which is, you know, it's kind of not no notes. It's not like, but there's nothing I want to pick apart. I mean, I want to talk about the series a lot because it's good, but I had that same sense of Neil Gaiman had mixed adaptations. I watched Good Omens, but I wasn't a fan of the original. I hadn't read it, so it didn't have that resonance to me. And then this just felt like, I think Masterful is right. It's just every note feels almost perfect or perfect. And I'm astonished at how well they did it. And I watched it with my 15-year-old who has not read any of the comics and barely knew anything about it. And they enjoyed it just as much as I did, which was, I think, an incredible thing given the amount of lore there is.
I want to second everything that my wife and my secret boyfriend just said.
not secret anymore, Chip.
I was reading Sandman pretty much in real time as it was published in 22-page floppy editions. I came to it just after like what we'd say is the second trade paperback, and was quite into it. And I love this series quite a bit. And what I'm very interested in is how people who haven't read the comic series react to it. Sandman was a big deal in comic circles, but it was never a giant seller. A couple of special issues, the series finale perhaps, but you know, it wasn't competing with X-Men and Batman at the time. It was really its own thing for the Vertigo crowd, for the sort of elite comic book readers at the time. Maybe
no, you
could
have left elitist.
Whoa,
that
whoa,
was
whoa,
fine.
Whoa, 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 whoa! You're correct.
The fantasy fans, the fantasy fans every year.
Yeah, we made the point on the Thor Love and Thunder episode recently that even Iron Man back in 2008 wasn't exactly a household name. Sandman, I don't think, has ever been a real household name except to really dedicated genre fans. And now it's been introduced to a Netflix audience, and I'm really fascinated to see because I'm too close to it. I love it. I can pick apart some stuff, but it is the Sandman. It is the Sandman of the comics.
It is. I mean, I was young when it was coming out. I read it as it was being collected in trades in the late 90s. So I wasn't reading it as it was being published in the early 90s. Also, I think I probably would have been too young for the subject matter. My sense is that, and you know, I've done zero research to back this up, but my sense was that it was extremely popular for a non-superhero comic, but we were still in the era where, you know, that there was a huge gulf between your superhero comics and your everything else comics.
Your Cerebus readers.
Yeah.
There was a lot of tricky stuff coming out in the 80s. Is I got introduced to comics, not really collecting, but like, you know, sort of reading by some friends in college, and they would, and a little after, and they would introduce me things like, you know, Concrete or Nexus or things like that, that were very anti-hero, non-hero, difficult, sometimes long, like languorous issues in which practically nothing happened and they were meditations. And so I think Sandman coming into that, even though I didn't read it when it first came out, it fit kind of perfectly into that.
I will say I reread the Sandman issues that are adapted into the show roughly right after watching the show, which, you know, I'd probably read them 5 or 6 times before. But it's, you know, there are appearances, kind of cameo appearances by several DC Comics superheroes. And, you know, I'm sure that there were probably licensing reasons why those don't show up in the TV show. But also, they feel ridiculous, right? It's like, these are not adding anything.
That was
anything.
A smart move.
It was like, probably we were like, you know, culturally or contractually obligated to do this when we were writing this in 1990. But like, reading them now, it's just like, why? why is Martian Manhunter here? Whatever.
I think a friend gave me I have a single issue. It's a reprint. It's not an original of Midsummer Night's Dream, which is a story that has not been adapted yet. But a friend gave it to me saying, you'll like this because you like Shakespeare. And I was, you know, I read some comic books and stuff, but I was basically in the curated experience where people I knew who were more into it than I was would like be like, you should read this or you should read this. And so somebody gave me that issue and I read it and thought, this is wild. I think I then borrowed, he had all the graphic novels and I borrowed them all from him and read them, sort of tore through them. And then I did buy the first two Absolute volumes. I don't have the last two, which now makes me super upset because I don't have a complete set of them. Also, they're basically impossible to read because they're so huge.
Damn, but, what if you needed something to make sure? Yeah, you need all four. You got to put one in each corner of your house to make sure the foundation settles.
Well, yeah, evenly. It is important. But I mean, I think for me, I loved all the metafictional elements of Sandman. It actually has a lot, as I was thinking about watching it this time. It reminds me a lot in some ways of the Stephen King's The Dark Tower in terms of how it plays with story and fiction and narrative, and just mixing all these sort of various genres and stuff like that. And they both are these huge expansive epic works. I like many of you felt like they had seen the news for years about them trying to make different adaptations and never coming to fruition. And I'm glad compared to The Dark Tower, which got a really lousy movie, that they did this with an actual TV show, which fits it way better.
Now, Sarah, in addition to being a very smart person with smart things to say, I believe we have also recruited you specifically because you are not someone who had come to the comics and then come to the show. You came to the show first, correctly?
That is true. I am what? Yeah,
I'm. What's that been like?
Oh well, I'm one of Chip's like rare people that have not read Sandman. I've also not dated Chip, so I'm being sick at that.
None of us are perfect. Sarah,
I know this is terrible. It's. I feel like it's a hole in my life. I know. I knew about the Sandman comics simply because being part of geek culture, you hear about them, you hear about the characters, you see the references. I think friends had death. Like tattooed on their body somewhere. I heard about it. And I actually knew that this was coming up simply again through geek circles, even before the promotion started. So I was really interested in it because I remember when I walked into The Martian by Andy Weir, the film, I had read the book ages ago. And I walked into the cinema going, don't screw this up, don't screw this up, don't screw this up. Because I loved the book so much, although I didn't use the word screw, I used something else. And I came out of the cinema going, oh, thank God they didn't screw it up. This was awesome. So I kind of saw my Sandman loving friends in the same kind of light. They were going into the Sandman this comic that they've absolutely loved and like you could tell how much passion they had, and people felt really strongly, which I know geeks who knew. So I was a little bit concerned going in that it was going to ruin it for them. So I was a little bit worried. But on the other hand, we had Good Omens, which everybody absolutely loved. So I had hopes that Neil Gaiman would have taken the helm and piloted us through this. And I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved it. I binged it within a few nights because it was wonderful. I have now downloaded the 30th anniversary versions onto Apple Books because getting it through Amazon is a pain in the patootie because it's rights issues in New Zealand. Anyway, I have volume 1 and volume 2 of the 30th anniversary on my iPad, but I'm holding off, and I specifically held off till after this podcast, Tony, so I was not spoiled at all.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated, Sarah, that it was so important to you that the fans like us who'd been there for so long would feel well served, because I'm really glad that you liked it. I'm really hugely glad that you liked it, but I can't separate in some ways, how glad I am that it was faithful to whether or not I can, you know, I loved it, but I've got no independent vantage point on whether it was good. And I do know some of my friends in fandom circles who didn't care for it, who didn't get it, and didn't have the benefit of, 75 issues of comic books to fall back on.
Yeah, I'll say there was some exposition issues. I mean, this is where, Alex once served as, what do we call them? We did some Dungeons and Dragons, and Tony called Alex my, not
spell
concierge.
Caddy.
Spell caddy, that's right. Yeah. So I was... I was Alex's a Spanman concierge for dictionary or something for this. So there were times when they were like, "What? Why did Cain just kill Abel? Like, is Abel gone now?" And I'm like, "Okay, you have to wait. That'll make sense. Like, what is Stephen Fry doing here?" And, okay, there were points where they had, I wouldn't say difficulty following the narrative, but there were things planted that I think were completely obvious and understood to those of us who had read the comics and remembered them to some extent. So we're just like, oh, that's that thing. And now we get the payoff. Hooray. Yeah. Where as a casual viewer, they were, I think, confused a few points because it was such a big ask of them to hold off understanding. So I don't think that's necessarily a flaw. I think a lot of media obviously does that. And I actually really love anything that doesn't hold me by the hand
throws you in the deep end sort of.
Yeah. That was my major thing, was that like, I don't like being held by the hand. Ooh. I like being left a tad unmoored. Now I'm no, ingenue, so I can actually I did know a little bit about it thanks to osmosis from the geek community, I'm not completely and innocent, but
we have basically talked about how great this show is without even giving, I guess I kind of assume that most people would have some familiarity with it, but let's pretend you've been listening to a podcast for roughly 20 minutes about how great Sandman is and are not sure what it's about. You're 30,000 foot view here is the Sandman is about the titular Sandman, who is the Lord of Dreams, but the actual personifications of dreams. He is just called Dream or sometimes Morpheus, and he is part of a family called the Endless, which are basically personifications of things like death and destiny and desire. They all start with D's. The adventure slash things they get into, the kind of initial hook of the series is Dream gets imprisoned by some, human cultists for an extended period of time. Bad things happen in the world. Dream gets free and then has to rebuild a lot of things that will take him into conflict and collaboration with all manner of strange creatures and beings and people. And, to me, the thing that's kind of amazing about Sandman and a lot of Neil Gaiman's other works is just stories that are about things that you have not heard before or seen before, and there is this big hook of, do you want to follow around a character who is this mysterious personification of dreams? Is that a ride that you're willing to buy a ticket for or not? So
the Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Let us sound the silent spoiler horn. We are now into specifics about the characters, the episodes, and what have you. I encourage you, if you haven't checked out The Sandman yet, why not do that? And then come back and listen to us talk about it. Friends?
Yes. What thing that strikes me the most is that first series of the comics, which runs parallel to the first half of the series on Netflix, that Gaiman was able to, or had to, narratively speaking, take this very grim, serious, almost ponderous main character as his protagonist. He had to imprison him for a century so that the readers would feel sympathy for him. that is like something you just can't do with live action. You can't have a protagonist so unlikable, you know, that and not really surround him with anybody. It's like, you know, the first episode you have, you know, this mysterious character who doesn't speak, who just glares through from his prison out of his glass fishbowl at the people who captured him. And there's really not any sympathetic characters to find. And it takes the, in my opinion, master acting of Tom Sturridge to make people feel for the character Dream, to introduce emotional beats that will draw the audience in. And bless his heart, he did it without saying a word, without a stitch of clothing on, sitting there in that fishbowl for an entire episode. And yet he was able to draw, I think, just his charisma and his acting was able to draw the audience in.
I was very happy with the casting for this show. Many of these were actors that I was not familiar with, but I thought they either embodied the look or the personality of the characters kind of exactly how they were in my head. Even there are a couple places where there are some characters that are gender bent or a different race than they presented as in the comic, but like the heart of the characters are there so perfectly that it totally works for me. And I was not familiar with Tom Sturridge from anything before, but he to me was perfect in the way that Dream is depicted. And, you know, Dream looks different in different Sandman comics. Sandman goes through a variety of artists and Dream sometimes looks different than one issue to the next and appears physically in different forms, depending on kind of what he is up to. It has various wardrobes, sometimes things that are kind of quite fantastical in terms of like flowing cloaks that like just like take up the atmosphere versus just a guy in a black leather jacket who looks like a goth walking down the street. But I thought he did great at that. They do, the version of Dream in the show is definitely a lot softer. If you can believe that, people who haven't read the comics, the version of Dream in the comics is, I mean, there is the idea that basically the Endless in their immortality and their kind of distance from humanity are at times cruel and uncaring and just do not, you know, kind of, have these whims where sometimes humans get punished or humans or dreams or nightmares or whatnot. They can do things that feel very kind of thoughtless and careless and mean. And I think they buffed off some of those edges. You know, it is part of what makes the comics interesting is that, you know, Sandman is, it's not a superhero comic. Sometimes it's a fantasy comic. There's elements of horror. A lot of Vertigo comics back then were, you know, Vertigo was kind of the place where it's like DC is our superhero comics and Vertigo is our place where we're gonna stick all the horror stuff over here. So there is things
we're going
that
to play
happen
with our suggested for mature readers label there.
So there are
mandatory. I mean, Vertigo, it felt like in the 90s, there was definitely an element of like Vertigo. It's like, well, if you got to earn your space in the Vertigo imprint by doing, it's like, you know, HBO, right?
Where I was going to say, well, it feels HBO, like early HBO. Nudity, right? It's like there's got to be some nudity that's not part of the story and some violence that's disturbing. And, you know, it was, some of it does not serve the story so much as it's like stuff so that we can make it clear that kids don't read this.
One thing that I found very interesting about this adaptation was really, first of all, taking that part to heart, right? Like the adaptation is not the thing itself. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you're changing media, then things are going to not work or work like differently, right? In a different medium than on the page. So, you know, and obviously we'll probably talk a little bit later about maybe some of the furor around some of this from certain uneducated corners of the internet. I don't know what to say.
Jerk, Stan.
Unenlightened.
Jerks.
Uninvolved. Thank you. Yeah, there you go. All those things. But I thought what was interesting and what I really liked about this, and I think, you know, this is where Gaiman's experience with Good Omens sort of comes into play, is kind of gives you a second bite at the apple, right? Like, you know, he made this fantastic work, but it's also a work that's 30 years old.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of stuff
by
in
a
there.
Relatively young fellow, right?
And
author,
so there's stuff
right?
in there that not only doesn't necessarily align with perhaps the way society has changed in 30 years, but also just he has refined his storytelling. And I think one of the strengths of the show is being able to sort of rejigger narrative elements and streamline things. And like, you know, we mentioned the DC Comics cameos and how those don't happen. Like all of that is to the good in terms of making this story stronger. And what struck me most about that was, I think the first volume of Sandman is not my favorite.
No, it's
it's not the
it's not one of the best.
Say,
like, there are times I've gone back when I've done my rereads, I skip the first section because it's like, nah, I've seen that, you know. And to me, some of the highlights just, are later or the later stories.
Yeah. but the episodes that built that story this time around, I felt much more compelling just because of the fact that he's able to rearrange the elements and sort of weave stuff in together and make it a much stronger story overall. Like, and a lot of that, you know, goes to, you know, the casting and stuff like that, but also just thinking about the adaptation of how do I move a comic to the screen in the same way that with Good Omens, he had to move a book to the screen. And that's an art in and of itself. So big kudos on that front for being able to be like, hey, I'm not going to just, even though there are scenes that are feel, you know, they are basically directly ripped from panels in the comics, it's used sparingly. Not every shot is just a recreation. This isn't Zack Snyder's Watchmen. Not every shot is a recreation of a panel from the page.
It hits the iconic ones.
Yeah, I'd say, too, there was two things that emerged for me that watching the series that I thought were very strong that are, again, in the comic books, but they're longer running themes because the comics ran over such a longer period of time. And I think this may be part of why the show can be compelling to fresh watchers, because I saw this with a fresh eye. The first is that there's this, I think, very strong statement that Dream was captured and then the world went to crap. And so everyone wants an explanation. Like, why did the entire world go crazy before World War One? Like, what happened that we had this sort of worldwide destruction of norms and mass death? Like, these things have been going on in different ways across history. Of course, you can't just say it happened in 1906 or 11 or whatever year. But I think the series posits very strongly that the absence of Dream caused much of the world's ills. Now, Gaiman can't, unfortunately, deliver us from those ills by just doing a TV series, but it is an interesting framing to say, why did we have suddenly world wars and destruction and Holocaust and this endless horror and this change in life? Well, here's one explanation, right? Is a fundamental force of the universe was captured and it put everything out of order. And so the series gets to use that. He's got to put things back in order. But the other theme, and it's obviously in the comics, but I think really, really emphasized here is how much this force of nature created by humanity, or by consciousness, I should say, the consciousness of the universe creates these seven different forces is kind of the implication. You know, death says the first living thing died, I was there, right? But she wasn't there before then. And so Dream thinks of himself as unchanging. And in this series, he changes substantially. And in the books, it takes a lot longer, obviously. You don't want to see a character introduced and then immediately go through transformations. You have to spend all this establishing time in the comic books to make them this sort of almost seemingly cruel, implacable force, and then to see that sort of break down. And so I thought the series did a great job of not, you know, it's that kind of thing. I'm a big Rex Stout fan, right? And in the first, I think it was, from the 80s, they did an adaptation of the Nero Wolfe novels. And Nero Wolfe's most famous characteristic is that he never leaves his brownstone. And the first episode, he left his brownstone. I'm like, oh, you can't do that. So here I had the same reaction. Like, even the first episode, we had seen Dream change. We'd seen him exercise forgiveness. It would, you know, even after being in captivity for 100 years, or even anger, it wouldn't have worked. And so they kind of, they pulled it out, and particularly that wonderful episode with death, like that becomes a fulcrum, you know, or a pivot that lets them open it up. And anyway, I thought that arc was so beautifully explored here without disturbing that fundamental kind of critical component of what these, you know, personifications are supposed to be.
I want to lean into that for a second, because we'll talk, I think, later on about what we know, those of us who've read the comics all the way through, what we know about where the story is going and how we feel about how this all sets it up. But one big difference that I noticed between this series and the comics is that it is a warmer story than the comics were. Not, you know, the characters are more fleshed out, a little more, you know, you're giving your actors something to do. These characters in the comics, you know, Morpheus is forbidding and foreboding and much more icy in a lot of places. it's not quite so here with Tom Sturridge. And to the point that when the Sandman is required to be icy, when he takes the baby, when he unmakes the Corinthian, when he turns his back on his wife, on his lover who was in hell, you know, it almost seems a little out of place. And that is one of the areas where, again, some of my friends in fandom who haven't been into the comics, they found these characters, some of them anyway, difficult to relate to, difficult to get anything out of. And this is another one of those times when I really want to turn over to Sarah and say, how did these characters grab you?
Well, like Dan, I kind of broke it up into the season. Into three parts. We had the first part, we kind of had that one episode interregnum, and then we had the second part. And the first part was the strong part for me. That was the bit that like really resonated. I enjoyed the second part, the bit after the interregnum with Rose, etc. But the first bit really resonated for me. And to your point about like whether or not Dream's coldness, his inhumanity came through because he was warmer than the comics. I think it almost made it more jarring that it was more impactful because Tom Sturridge's Dream was warmer, was softer. That when the inhumanity came through, you were like, "Oh, right, yes, okay, this is not a person. This is not someone who's human that I would expect humanity from." And that it was almost like. I was being lulled into a false sense of security. So when he popped out and his inhumanity arose, I was like, "Oh, yep, that's right." If I had one criticism, I would have liked that a little bit more frequently because that would have destabilized me more. Because I would have felt like, okay, anything could happen. But because in places he was almost too human, I was like, okay, it's like I could predict what was going to occur because it was like, okay, what would a human do? But if we'd had more glimpses of the inhumanity of Dream, of the endless, then I would have seen... more possibilities for things to get really screwed up because I wouldn't have known what he was going to do. So there was nothing that was like completely unpredictable to me. And I would have liked a higher degree of unpredictability.
I was just sort of thinking back a bit to the contrast of, you know, Dream being so inflexible and firm about, you know, his role. He's got to get his tools back so he can resume his role and that driving the first half of the story so much. And then what I thought, as Glenn was talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, we are seeing changes in Dream much sooner compared to the comics and how that's kind of reflected in minor character story arcs. I was like super, super taken with the Doll's House section, the second half of the season, and what they did, especially with the character Gaunt, the third escaped nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the comics, they do something completely different. And there's reasons for that that we can talk about when we get into like firmly into comic territory. That was especially a section where I would be going like, I'd be watching and going like, wait, that's different from the comics. And then like by the end of that episode or at the latest, by the end of the next episode, I'd be like, oh, OK, I see why they needed to do that. So, you know, going back to how well adapted it is. But Gaunt's mini arc of not wanting to be a nightmare anymore and defying Dream in that aspect, escaping, finding Jed and protecting, making her mission to her, the mission, her reason to protect him and try to take care of him, assuming the role of his mother, because, you know, Rose and Jed's mother is a presence in the comics. She's, you know, she's there as a character. But then. At the end, Dream is playing in his sandbox and making and recreating her. He gives her wings. Literal metamorphosis. And the way I feel that's going to foreshadow things to come, but even if it didn't, in and of itself, it's such a gloriously pretty message. It's beautiful, mm-hmm. and I love it.
I appreciate, we've talked a lot about Dream, who, it makes sense, it's a big deal, the show's named after him, but I appreciate the depictions of his, I guess, the kind of sidekicks, Lucien the librarian, mm-hmm. and Matthew the raven, who I think help the viewer along by kind of asking questions and framing things,
yes.
and being a person for Dream to talk to, and, you know, comics have a thing where there can be more voiceovers and just, you know, character thinking themselves in a box of text, and that doesn't work for TV. But the you know, the way they use Lucien and Matthew the Raven really works to kind of move things along, and I think it helps that I was
worried Patton Oswalt was going to be too Patton Oswalt, and I thought he was absolutely perfect. I thought they used
he's a little reserved for Patton Oswalt maybe, but it works.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly it. But I think they used his nature, and even for, you know, a lot of people, he's obviously, well, people are aware of him. I think there's a little bit of that expectation of how Patton Oswalt usually presents himself that I think worked, because he's got such an expressive voice, and I think he does do a great job in animation and in this, you know, sort of pseudo animation voicing a raven. But even that whole little bit with Jessamy, with the raven the mm-hmm. dying, mm-hmm. that I don't, is that in the comics? I don't even remember
it's if it not.
Is
it's, I don't, it's a, oh, not in it, the I same way
it's a,
not in the,
it's yeah. a beautiful it's a beautiful bit it's a beautiful layering they put in, and then you bring in Matthew. One thing they haven't, I don't want to, this isn't that much of a spoiler thing, but the thing I don't think they've really done except with Matthew is the idea that Dream's subjects are, you know, his, the people who are dreaming often serve Dream or serve the dreaming. Mm-hmm. And I think Matthew is the only one who said, well, I died and then suddenly I'm a raven. It's like, oh yeah, well, that's kind of a whole other thing. But I'm thinking of the scene in which, in the comics, in which a bunch of sleeping people are acting as servers at a table.
At a dinner,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, wait, don't I know you? And they're all dressed in bedclothes, in pajamas and things. And I thought, I wonder if they'll bring more of that in, because it's a clever conceit. Anyway, but I thought Matthew, he appeared so much, like he became such a big part of the show, but I thought they used him very well. I thought they used mm-hmm. him and Patton Oswalt very well.
I know some people, and maybe that was you, Shannon, in the Slack a couple weeks or months back, you know, there are things that in the comics Dream kind of has to do alone, and they feel kind of perhaps desolate and different tonally versus in the show, Matthew tags along. And I feel like Matthew's role is basically to be like, what the heck is going on? And so the Dream has to like explain what the heck is going on for us. Shannon, you were going to say something.
Just briefly, to one tiny counterpoint. I have run across a couple of people who I don't remember if they read the comics or just watched the show, but I have had a couple people saying like, I couldn't get past the fact that was Patton Oswalt talking. Mm. It's like, well, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he does a lot of voice acting. He does not have a, I think his performances have a range. He is not a voice actor who has a range of voices.
Right.
So it is, I will say, you know, Patton Oswalt voices MODOK in an animated show.
Yes.
And it's, you know, it's kind of an Adult Swim, you know, Robot Chicken-y, manic violence kind of thing. And it's the same voice. It was very jarring, similarly to go from, you know, the voice of Ted Lasso is a hitman on Hitmonkey. And it's like, what now? You murder people? It is hard when people, their voice is so iconic.
I did like that contrast.
Yeah. It is an interesting bit in terms of this show. I mean, you mentioned, I think, Tony, you said at the beginning, like a lot of these actors, Tom Sturridge included, are not people who are necessarily household names or super popular and known in other places. I did think it was interesting in cases where there are people, like I'm trying to think of other people who sort of jumped out at me, might be Gwendolyn Christie and Jenna Coleman,
who I think
also, you know, this show does a nice job in most places of sort of making sure that A, it's not super distracting when you recognize somebody, and also having like these elevating, lesser known actors. I think the one actor who got me, because I stared at them for a while being like, why do I know this person, was actually Sarah Niles.
Oh, yes. I had the same reaction.
Like, who is that? Why do we know her?
I
recognized
her instantly. And oh my God, that sequence, I mean, was masterfully crafted even as it was.
Yep.
To have Rosemary drive John D to his destination. And, you know, I am sitting here, I mean, Chip can testify. I was on like literal pins and needles going like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, not her, not her, not her, not her. So for those of us who like knew comics and knew Sarah Niles and loved her because of Ted Lasso.
Yeah, she's the therapist in Ted Lasso.
Oh my God, I was on the edge of my seat that scene. I was just like, this, no, mm-hmm. please no. And I don't know if her not dying was the right outcome. As much as I didn't want her killed, I got to the end. It was like, so why didn't they kill her?
I have to assume that that's going to go somewhere. I don't know. It felt like things happened for a reason in the show. It is a loose end, right?
They were trying to do more of a. I feel like this show is more about redemption than the comics ever were. And I think that's a theme. There's a lot of things that are being redeemed, and even in the end of that episode, the fact that Dream says, you know, I can't really hold you. I can't remember exact words, but it's no human was supposed to ever be exposed to this. So what happened to you, you can't be held to account in the way that, you know, some other power would or what have you. You're a tool. And he recognizes that John D is being used as part of the tools of all the machinations of desire and so forth. But I think for redemption, and also I have to think they did that because they knew that everyone who read the comics knows that searing. I mean, when that episode, I'm like, oh no, it's this episode. Am I ready to watch this? I know what's going to come and how are they going to portray it? And I think they did an incredible job.
I didn't remember it at all.
Oh my God. It just seared in my memory that issue or was it a couple issues? And then it resonates in the future too.
The issue is 24 hours. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and so, but those of us who remembered it, right? They whatever percentage of Netflix viewers are, I feel like that was also set up. Oh, we can subvert everyone's expectation because we're totally in. You know, we admire this character. We see how she's dealing with the situation. We expect she'll be killed, and in fact, we get our. You know, there is more redemption. He redeems her because, I feel he's presented in the comic books as a much simpler character, someone who's been driven around the bend, where here he's a driven character. He has intent. Mm.
That scene in the diner was just one of the best scenes in the entire series. It was traumatizing. It was that feeling of inhumanity that I kind of felt was a little bit missed in Dream was present in what John D was doing in that because at a certain point with that scene, I could almost, anything could happen. The most horrible thing that I could imagine could happen. And it was possible for that to occur. That scene, that whole passage there with, in the diner was traumatizing as hell. And it had that possibility of anything occurring that I felt was possibly a little bit missing in Dream.
Yeah, but that also may be sort of, you know, one of the reasons that Rosemary is spared and, you know, Dee has, you know, gone, you know, or claiming that, you know, the stone is going to defend him rather than saying that he's the one killing the security guards when he escapes the psychiatric ward, when he kills the gas station attendant. You know, the idea is that, you know, oh, if you attack me, it's going to protect me and do horrible things to you. So, you know, and then he turns around and decides that, you know, Rosemary is a good enough person that deserves protection, that deserves to live out the rest of her life. So that when he goes into the diner and we've got this nice mix of people, you know, some of them seem to be really sweet. Some of them, you know, they have some issues. and so you genuinely, like, I think it helps keep the suspense there for... Mm. Who's going to live, who's going to die, that are trapped in there.
Did you think the guy in the chef in the kitchen or the cook in the kitchen, I felt he really did some good. I think the acting was independent. I'm not saying this, that he was ripping somebody off for their style, but it was very Nick Offerman. I was like, I could picture that whole scene in Nick Offerman's voice.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Something I wanted to throw out, sorry to change the years too fast, but I think we should discuss the Corinthian. Because I wanted to give credit to Boyd Holbrook's presence and his performance in this show. I thought was, that's a tough character to sort of get inside the head of. And in fact, I actually found him much more frightening in the comics than I did here.
Yeah.
But he's very sinister here, which I kind of enjoy. But he's got like a lot, there's more depth to him here, I think, than there is in the comics.
He does more. He's a little bit just a force of nature in the comics.
Yeah, he's more present, and he kind of has an interesting drive behind him that I think is maybe a little bit more vague in the comics, whereas he is just like, you know, this boogeyman in many
ways.
There's
also, I feel like, I don't remember if this is in the comics, but the kind of, you know, so he ends up at a serial killer convention, not
great.
A serial fan convention. That's across town. Yeah. Don't get them mixed up. But there's kind of the suggestion, because he is this nightmare that's been wandering around for 100 years, that he is kind of the... he is inspired directly or indirectly a generation of serial killers, murderers, hateful people, that I think, as Dream calls them, very small people that, you know, have tried to build themselves up as gods.
Yeah, that largely comes from the comic. Yeah. It's a real eye for detail.
Yeah. And it tightens up the series to make the Corinthian the one that Dream was trying to capture at the beginning when he himself is captured. And then there's 100 years where the Corinthian can keep going doing whatever he wants to
do. Exactly.
Rather than it being some vague battle that had worn Dream out and therefore made him weak enough to be captured.
The narrative structure of the show is a little bit tighter and a little bit more structured. I mean, the first chunk of the comics is basically stuff is happening, and there's an explanation that, like, the vortices or vortex is drawing things together, and that's why characters converge, as opposed to here, you know, like the Corinthian is kind of hunting for things, right? So there's more intentionality in the show, which I think probably modern viewers of a show kind of need, as opposed to coincidence, or the coincidence is because of magic.
It's also funny, as you could think, like, if this were in the olden days when TV shows had 39 episodes a year or something like that, like 25, it's like this is sort of three or four, maybe three and a half seasons of a show that had more room. But, you know, I mean, I've seen Gaiman interviewed and talked about it. I do love how open he's being. He's like, this is a really expensive show. I don't know if we're going to make the numbers because it really costs a lot of money. And I got no complaints because Netflix funded it. They've been totally supportive, but they got to do what makes sense for them. And I'm like, yeah, but it was so expensive that they couldn't do 20 episodes or you know. And so you have this stuff that's really compressed.
It does. I mean, I think in some ways that's a good thing. I feel like there's a lot of Netflix series that have a lot of sag in the middle. It does feel a little bit like when they made this, they thought that maybe they'd only ever get one season, and so they better put it all on the line here. And I think there's a little bit more of the, like, Dream gets an arc in these that he does not get in the comics, and, you know, they need an arc for their protagonist. It is frustrating that, you know, my understanding is this show is extremely popular and was, you know, a huge hit on Netflix, but has not been renewed for a second season yet. And I mean, I guess it's that challenging thing where something can be very successful and popular, but maybe not successful and popular enough for how many zillions of dollars it costs.
It's a whole other episode about how Netflix does things.
Yeah. Insert standard rant here about how this really should have been a weekly drop.
Absolutely.
I've seen so many people talk about, you know, it's like, you know, the idea is that Netflix wants you to binge it all that weekend in a sitting. And so many people I've seen, like, you know, chatting online, I couldn't. I needed to savor it. I needed to do an episode a night or an episode every couple of nights because
there are some heavy episodes in here. Like, what would it do to your brain to watch these all in one sitting?
Yeah.
Also, speaking as someone who this came out like a week after I had a kid, like, there's no way I'm going to watch all of this in a weekend. Sorry, I don't have that kind of time.
You watched it 10 minutes a day for 40 days.
Yeah, I did savor it because of that.
Well, I think the feeling of like a second season is because like my one criticism of the Corinthian was he didn't feel like a real foil to Morpheus. He was a bad guy, and so he's your antagonist to your protagonist, but it was like he wasn't at the same level as Morpheus,
right,
and it's only at with the exception of John Dee, who I think could have been possibly such if they'd written the storyline differently, but it's only in the last episode that we discover who the actual antagonists are, and and it's like, okay, so now you're giving us an antagonist worthy of Morpheus, and you've dripped it to us, and yet you're not going to give us a second season.
Yeah,
what's up with that?
Even, you know, and even that they again, sorry for the constant connections to the comic, but like, you know, there's a scene where Desire like appears at the end of the episode, like, you know, rubbing their hands to me,
right,
like,
my plan
and it's like Desire doesn't show up in the comics until later, right? It's you know, but it's like they needed basically more to show you what's happening behind the scenes, and that, you know, the idea that one of, you know, Dream's siblings is plotting against Dream, and
nature of this series is that you're a primary character and his siblings are the universal personifications of absolutely indomitable forces: death, dreaming, desiring, despairing. You know, there is nothing bigger than them.
Yeah.
There's a MacGuffin that happens that traps Dream in a fishbowl. But other than that, there are no other characters other than the Endless themselves who can possibly be on Dream's
maybe
level.
Well,
Lucifer.
Also, and the Arrhenius. I mean, the Arrhenius are a much more important part
Chip,
of
Chip,
the...
Chip, let me introduce you to the first of the Fallen. that's a hell of a CV topper there,
Excuse me, in the comics, the first of the Fallen and the Lucifer were different characters.
Oh, and in the comics, Lucifer only co-rules hell. It's true.
They've left us with, you know, going into a putative second season, though. You do have Lucifer, you have Desire, you have Furies, the Arrhenius, who are much more important in the comics, but I really liked how they treated them here. So they're kind of, and even the Calliope, bonus at the end there, tying in, we suddenly get a glimpse of this other life of Morpheus, which is a huge deal in the comics and plays out over many, many issues. So you sort of feel like they've set up, I mean, from having kind of one big, well, you know, the disruption of Dream's control over the dreaming and his capture, and then the sort of one big, you know, and defeating John Dee, sort of defeating him, and then the one big bad who was easy to defeat. Now we go into, from this, they set up at least four and maybe more threads that could really explode. For people who've watched the series, they would come out of it thinking, oh, these are four things I need to keep track of, as opposed to people reading the comics where, you know, there's like 400 other things that they haven't brought up yet.
As David Schaub says in the chat, I appreciate this, Dream's primary antagonist is Dream.
He's not wrong.
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a series, again, drawing from a larger comics idea, it's not a series that's really about fighting a bad guy, right? It's not, it's an exploration of stuff, using all these different facets, but like to the point that I think, Chip, you were making, like, it's not like we're gonna like, all right, it's Dream versus Lucifer, who's gonna win in this punch-up? Like, even though we have those head-to-head confrontations, ultimately this is something, you know, it's a larger story about people and, you know, the world that we live in and all these sort of like numinous concepts dreaming and life and death and all of that. So it's, you know, viewed through a prism and a lens to sort of reflect this fantastical realm. But, you know, it's not a superhero comic where we're going to have them have a giant Infinity War style fight at the end.
Yeah, it's a journey. It is a character journey for Dream. And it just sort of hit me. I've seen, you know, here and there people saying like, well, the first half was so cohesive and was so good, and, you know, the second half didn't really grab me. But then so many people absolutely adore The Sound of Her Wings, the central episode with Dream talking to Death.
That was great.
And then his relationship with Hob. But the fact that, you know, Death is kind of the one who sort of calls it. She's like, you know, come on, dude, snap out of it, you know. And then he doesn't exactly snap out of it. I mean, the second half of the series is about he's got to deal with this vortex issue that is a danger to the dreaming. And for the most part, he's still kind of playing by his previous rules, and the traumas of him being imprisoned for that long don't seem to have affected him as much as we think until towards the end, when between Lucien and, you know, Rose herself and basically everyone giving another talking to, which results in the end of him, you know, going and, you know, giving Gaunt her wish to recreate her in a new form. So we see that, you know, yes, okay, he's absorbing the lessons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we only get a very little bit of Death, such a beloved character from the comics, and of course, just such a great character with the idea that, you know, the personification of Death itself, not a Grim Reaper, but a, you know, older sister, kinder, wiser goth, who's going to hang out with Dream and kind of give him a hard time about, like, you know, why so serious?
Why didn't you call me?
Yeah, why don't you ever pick up the phone, brother? What's the deal?
Well, he sort of blames her for not rescuing him, but she's like, you never, you know. I got the impression in the world of the TV series, I'm not sure if Dream could have asked for help. I feel like he could have and didn't, and maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I read that scene as that he was worried that if he called for Death, Death would be imprisoned. Mm-hmm. And
that makes sense.
And that was his concern for why he didn't call her. Now, yeah, again, yeah, like non-comic book reader here. So, but that was my reading of that scene, was that he didn't call her because he was worried she'd be captured and things would be worse.
My headcanon is kind of, you know, Dream is this extremely powerful being who has no friends. And basically, the people that could, the people that have the power to free him benefit or don't mind that he is captured. And he is kind of on his own, and that a lot of people don't care for his company, you know.
Now, think about Dream like Queen Elizabeth II, though. Mm. I was actually thinking about, and this is ridiculous, but it is true.
Well, you are talking, so.
Yeah, I'm talking. Ah, thank you. So, reference acknowledged. So, it's that, you know, Dream has all these strictures put upon him. So, he has incredible amount of power, but he has to exercise it in very specific ways, or ostensibly, he can't exercise it anymore. And I was thinking about how everyone, you know, as the Queen Elizabeth had all this power, and people thought about what a luxurious life she lived in, and the food she could eat, the freedom she had. And yet every day of her life was absolutely constricted. So, you know, yes, she did live in the lap of luxury. And yes, she did have all this, these resources and so forth, but the extent to which she could deploy them. And I thought it's actually a decent, you know, he is talking about himself as a ruler. And I think Death actually describes her role even more that way, that she was able to accept her role after however many, you know, billions of years, because she realized it was a role of service, that they all serve. And so whatever, you know, and it's that in the end, it's about serving humanity, because humanity created them as personifications, as opposed to being gods.
But I think it is a lot of it, and exactly in that way, it is the heavy is the head that wears the crown sort of situation. I mean, and part of it is Dream has put himself in that box, right? Mm. And I love the best evidence for this is what is, I think, my favorite story in the entire run of the comics, which is the story with Hob, which is just a wonderful story about essentially this guy who has no friends and then gets one friend, and how that makes such a difference, right? Like, you know, the whole back and forth with him and Hob, where like Hob is like, well, you know, we're friends, and Dream gets pissed, you know, because he's like, I'm too good to have friends.
I'm better than that.
Yeah, exactly. And of course he does need friends, right? Like, and I love, I love that scene in the comic, and also I think done really well here in the show, of showing that it is sort of the crack in his armor where he's like, I tear up in that scene where he's like, impolite to leave your friends waiting, right? Like that is it's a touching moment.
And of course we need a story that takes place over the course of 500 years to show changes in Dream's personality.
So. Also the costuming, please.
I loved Hobb, and I also thought the acting, I thought he was great.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
Also it's a good way to, I think, mediate that thing where, again, we're told that death has no control over what she does, and then she doesn't let this guy die. So,
right.
All I'm going to say is there is a reason that there are over 700 fanfics were written to ship Dream and Hob within the last month.
Reasonable.
That's, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, everyone in London is like, yeah, of course they're tearing down this place that was 500 years old. Yeah. Of course they are. And they're like,
I like that there's a sign, though. There's somebody spray paints the sign. Yeah. The pub's over here now.
Speaking of, I mean, we get the story with Hob paired with the story with Death, which makes a lot of sense. They're arranged differently in the comics, but... Yeah. And then we got as a treat a couple of weeks after the major drop, we did get an 11th episode of the season with another two stories. And if Sandman is to continue, it's going to be fascinating to see how they square the fact that the comic alternated between long story arcs and episodic drop-ins.
Yes.
And it's a little weird. Why is episode 11 split in half?
Why is it not 12 and 11 and 12? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Because
why is it released 2 weeks after the, you know, series? Because
one of my favorite comic stories of them all is ever in any title is A Dream of a Thousand Cats, which is animated beautifully. It's completely different from everything else that we get here. And then we get the story with Arthur Darvill, Calliope, and these are all great stories, I think, in and of themselves. They've got their parts that artistic choices that you could question and things like that. But it is an odd thing to end Sandman with episode 11 when you think that there might not be an episode 12. We basically close with the anthology episodes, and who knows?
I gotta say, this is a great indication, the Calliope episode, of the evolution of the presentation of Sandman too. Is I thought, as great as the comic books are, I think they are prurient in some points. You know, there's too much female nudity and sometimes male nudity intended entirely as a gratuitous element as opposed to something that's required by the plot. And sometimes it does that as well. And the treatment of Calliope was a perfect example of how you can take the same story. The core story is really good. It's nearly identical in all the important details. And I think it's told with more integrity the way it's presented.
I thought it was really, it's really well executed, and it's coming from, you know, a lot of places where we've had a lot of criticism about things, especially things like sexual violence depicted on screen, being over the top, being gratuitous, questioning whether or not it's necessary to depict that. I thought the way that was executed on screen here is just really artfully done. You don't need to show it. It's there. You can imply it. And everything that you need to know is shown in that frame of him with the scratch on his cheek. I think that was it felt to me a much more interesting and less prurient, as Glenn said, way to handle that conflict. And I also thought the casting Darvill, who is seems like a lovely fellow and like, you know, but also seems like the perfect kind of guy for this, where it's like, I'm a good guy, you know, I'm a good guy.
Yeah. I like to write strong female characters.
Not a shot at anybody else, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, don't bring that up.
That was incredible.
Yeah.
But it is, to Chip's point about the anthology stuff, it does make it fascinating, right? In some ways you can make this the argument for is this a reason why they, you know, yeah, obviously Netflix doesn't do weekly drops really, but like, it would be weird, right? Like, you know, 1 week you're like, oh, this week you're expecting your statement. Here's a story about cats. And you're like, yep. What? And then next week, here's a story about what? What's going on? Right?
Like, oh, God, I mean, it would be like waiting every month for a 22 page piece of paper to come out and then being like, why is this the way this is? Yeah. It would never work. It would never work.
But it is interesting to see, like, because there are so many variations in, you know, I think, was it Fables and Reflections, which is just like all sorts of weird, like standalone stories. I don't know. It would be fascinating to see. This is one of the reasons I think for years people have been like, this would be almost impossible to adapt mm-hmm. because it's all over the place. It's not that it's like, yeah. Oh, the special effects are too hard and it's too, you know, wild and out there and everything looks so, you know, outlandish on the page. It's like, no, the storytelling is unconventional in many ways, and it's kind of hard for people who are used to stand like a television show to digest. But I think we have at least gotten to the point where we can, you know, peak TV has helped us all figure out ways to consume these kinds of content.
Yeah. Although what's funny is watching a show like, you know, watching Rings of Power and Sandman, you're like, oh yeah, we have events happening over far more than the length of human lives, and sometimes spanning, you know, you're jumping back and forth hundreds or thousands of years, and like, trying to make a sense of that. I'm like, yeah, immortality is really a pain in the ass for storytelling.
It's true. Speaking of immortality, we should mention some other side characters that I think are just lovely in their depictions and casting. So we get Jenna Coleman as Joanna Constantine, and possibly her ancestor or something, Lady Joanna Constantine.
Definitely her ancestor.
Okay.
Licensing reasons, right? But I'm like, thank God for not another John Constantine.
I wasn't sure why the choice was there. We have other John Constantines walking around. There's a John Constantine on Legends of Tomorrow, played by Matt Ryan, who I very much enjoy. There might be another John Constantine Keanu Reeves movie coming. It was interesting to me that this is a gender flip Constantine, but also perhaps the most comics accurate depiction of Constantine I've ever seen.
The Matt Ryan version is pretty close in many regards.
This
yes.
one is even more so, I think, in terms of just, there's the 5 minutes when we're at the church with her and she's doing the is it going to be a wedding or is it going to be an exorcism? And, you know, the character name drops several minor characters from the Hellblazer comic books and is just of, yeah. And I don't know. I love that character. I don't know if that character resonated with other people.
Absolutely loved Joanna Constantine. Jenna Coleman was like, when she walked in, I was like, oh, it's Kara, and from a Doctor Who like fan.
So much Doctor Who-ish people in that. Well, especially in episode 11.
It's a small island, people.
Look, why did we get more Mad Hetty? That's my complaint. I wanted more Mad Hetty.
I was like, that is a pretty minor Hellblazer character who also appears in Sandman that they just like, you drop there. I guess you could do that. Yeah.
People were casually very old in this show. And I mentioned Alex at some point, I was like, wait, how old is she? She's 126. It's like, no one's going to comment on, not Charity. What's her name? The grandmother, the great grandmother, right?
Unity. Of
Unity. Yeah. Unity. Isn't she like 100? If you do the math, isn't she like 126?
Don't do the math.
And nobody cares.
She slept for a long time.
She was sleeping all the time. She was well preserved.
It's good for your cells. Also, she doesn't make it much further. So, you know. Sorry.
And not to mention the fact that there's a Floridian town that like apparently has like 3 million British people living in it because every other person in this Floridian town, like nobody mentioned, like, why do you all have British accents and you're like in the middle of Florida. I just don't understand this. So yeah, there are some moments where you're going, what? No.
I do want to second what Sarah said about Jenna Coleman. As a Doctor Who fan, I am familiar with her work, and and she is just great. And it was lovely. Yeah, it's a little funky to have her playing her ancestor as well. But in both worlds, it was solid. And I appreciate the callback feeling that, you know, here's Jenna Coleman playing a different version of herself in different time periods. She's pretty good at that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was a lot more confident, like, and together in her contemporary incarnation of Joanna Constantine. That you could tell that her ancestor wasn't on top of things as much as her contemporary version was.
Like to think she was, though.
Yeah, I like to think she was. Yeah. And honestly, I don't know if Matt Ryan... Well, no, I don't want to say Matt Ryan. Who's the one playing Legends of Tomorrow, John Constantine?
No, that's Matt Ryan.
That's Matt Ryan.
It is Matt Ryan. It's another Matt Ryan. I need to get these straight. Okay. I don't know if Matt Ryan's John Constantine would have worked in this situation. I felt that Joanna Constantine fitted better. I've loved Matt Ryan's John Constantine through the Legends of Tomorrow series and the abortive attempt at his own series, and I've enjoyed that character. But I would have felt it a little bit jarring to have him come across from Legends of Tomorrow, which
he wouldn't fit in this setting. There's some tone there that doesn't mesh. I was surprised that we get, like, there's more Constantine here than in the comic. Sorry for the comic stock. But again, specifically, there's Constantine origin stuff here that we get with Jenna Coleman in terms of showing that, you know, basically Constantine's origin as an occult detective is, you know, basically an early exorcism that went horribly wrong and a girl who gets doomed to hell and, you know, because of his mistakes and that he's walking around with that guilt. And also we get the, you know, guess what? Everyone who comes into John Constantine's life suffers for it, and we have the ex-girlfriend who is, you know, addicted to sand, and things don't go great for her, you know.
It's a great way to collapse the characters, though, because there's so many characters in the comic books, it'd be way too much for the series. And again, I think that's the economy of collapsing plot and character while totally retaining the integrity. I mean, just everything. Stephen Fry, when I knew Stephen Fry was in the show, and I'm like, oh, of course he's going to be Fiddler's Green. And then that anticipation of waiting for him to appear, and when he does, and you're like, oh, of course that's how he's going to appear. He's going to dress practically like Oscar Wilde, which is visiting America in the 1800s. And it's kind of the way he's depicted in the books too. It's not like it's a different thing, but I'm like, of course, this is the perfect role for Stephen Fry. And then he executed it with that. I mean, with a perfect nature. So, so happy to see him like an old friend in the middle of this show that is, you know, full of sort of different kinds of old friends.
Yeah. I will admit that didn't work for me. I felt Stephen Fry was being Stephen Fry.
Yeah, it's the same. It's a little too, whereas I lose myself in, I think, every other role in this. There's a couple people, it's like, hey, you're from Taskmaster. You have a job now. Good for you. but Stephen Fry, it's a little bit like, I am constantly, you are Stephen Fry. I can't.
That character is kind of Stephen
Fry.
And
for me, who has seen almost nothing, I've seen almost nothing of Stephen Fry, and he was just, oh my God, yes, he's a perfect Fiddler's Green, and he did so well.
I feel like Stephen Fry Stephen Fry's current personality is either based on Fiddler's Green or vice versa, because they are very, it's like how Mark Twain became Mark Twain late in life.
Yeah. And, but then of course there's, Gwendolyn Christie is Lucifer.
Brilliant.
And again, another character who exists in, I have not seen it, but a popular cop show.
I have seen every single episode of Lucifer because my girlfriend forced me to. And and so I watched all of it. And there's another character that would not have worked in this. Not remote. A part of me was like, are they going to do it? No.
It's hard. David Bowie's not available. And so we got to do what we can. We soldier on. We're casting other people.
If you can swap out Gwendolyn Christie for David Bowie, I'm willing to roll with that.
You'll give it a try.
Is that if we swapped out Jenna Coleman for Sting? Is that what
that's the math, Dan? Thank you for doing
very
it.
Very funny.
Just checking.
Comics references aplenty, Sarah. Yeah. You're going to enjoy it.
Brilliant.
I think Gwendolyn Christie is fantastic. I always enjoy her. If anything, my main complaint is that there are things that she's in Star Wars where she's underused, and it was like, why did you bring Gwendolyn Christie in for that? And they did they gave the Lucifer character more to do here than in the original comics, which I appreciated. And I assume setting up for even more Lucifer should the show return.
And we got Mazikeen. I thought, you know, yet another Mazikeen. I was like, oh, that's awesome. Like, it just, it's funny. For characters from hell, I'm always like, Mazikeen, I think she's one of my favorite characters.
Oh, Glenn.
Secondary characters. Come on.
Oh, you are, yeah, the thing she's is, Mazikeen in the TV show, oh, man. Lucifer. Oh,
she's wonderful.
She's really wonderful. Now, she's a character and an actress that would have worked if they picked her up and moved her over into the... Totally would have 100% worked.
Totally right.
Yeah, 100%.
That character doesn't have as much to do here.
No.
So, you know, but maybe in the future.
Mm-hmm. And as far as secondary characters, one more that we haven't really touched on that I think deserves a little bit of attention is Lucienne.
Oh, yeah.
The way Vivienne Achampong, I don't know how to pronounce her name, just is so utterly brilliant in walking the line between trying to take care of the dreaming and serve dream versus trying to, you know, resisting smacking him upside the head, you know, which, you know, death can get away with that. You know, death can throw a baguette at dream. Lucienne can't. So Lucienne has to find other ways to try and convince dream, like, you know, these are some of the steps we need to take. And yet still and yet still showing how much that, you know, she cares about her lord and master, you know, like that worries about him. Wanting him to take a raven with you. Don't lose touch again.
It tells me how weak part of the show was. And I think maybe, I don't know if we'll all agree. Maybe I'll bring up this as a point of contention is the last part. I did not find the whole Rose Walker thing that compelling. I enjoyed it. And I thought there were a lot of side quests going on at the same time that were a little more interesting. And I thought the whole serial killer's presentation, like there was a little much of it, but I thought it was done very well and enjoyably in that context and the portrayal and setup. But Rose Walker, I mean, we haven't mentioned, I think we barely mentioned that whole plot. And that is kind of the whole second half. There's a little bit of a by the numbers thing where they're putting pieces together to make happen. And then they need a resolution of it. And again, I watch this show so avidly. I'm not saying, well, that part was terrible or something, but I do think it demonstrates we're talking so much about the front loading and the standalone episodes. And that part, it's like, well, that was kind of a key plot thing. And it just gets a little by the way.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's enjoyable. It's interesting, but it doesn't stick with me, I guess, the same way.
I didn't feel like she was in any danger. I didn't feel there were stakes for her, even though there are huge stakes for her.
Yeah, I think it varies somewhat for, you know, I wound up enjoying it very much because that the Doll's House is a volume of the comics that I reread on the regular because I like so many of the secondary characters. And I feel like most of the actors involved were able to bring them to life very well. You know, like I thought Hal was a darling, for example. And I was really and the fact that Jed was an actual front and center character compared to the comics, where we don't see a whole lot of him, the move to make him, you know, and this is, again, comic illusions, I'm sorry, to make him the Sandman hero in his dream world. And therefore, you know, make it make sense, because, of course, that's a little kid's dream. And, you know, any of the hokiness that, you know, if they had tried to do it the way it's originally done in the comics, would not have flown. It just would not have flown. It works in the comics because they are referencing a specific classic comic, Little Nemo. So the art style and the dialogue works there because it's an homage, and that wouldn't have come across in TV. So they reworked that entire section brilliantly. I personally enjoyed it, found it engaging. I can understand for some people, you know, why it may have been like, well, I'm not sure why this is, you know, why this is several arcs worth of plot.
Yeah, no, it didn't. I mean, again, I feel like I'm nitpicking. So I enjoyed it. It was fun. I enjoyed the character development of Morpheus. But yeah, I that particular arc with Rose just didn't. It was missing something.
There's an element of it where it's is it grounded in reality or is it fantastical? And there's something with this weird in between where she's at this house in Florida briefly, and there's these very, very strange characters there with the Ken and Barbie and the, in my head, they're slotted as Spider Sisters, though maybe they're sisters, maybe they're not. And then, you know, like Fiddler's Green living up in the attic is the normal one. And there's, I think there's kind of the, like, what is going on versus what is this view from, I get Rose is not a kid, but a very young adult. And then there's kind of sandwiched in with that, like her missing brother who is like being abused and left in a basement. And it's just, there's kind of, I guess there's the, you know, we have the diner scene where it feels like we have these normal people. And then through proximity to the fantastical, they get, everything gets heightened and weird. And here we have these things that seem to just be weird before anything happens.
I also thought the Leda Hall character, I was watching it and I couldn't remember the character very well. And I was like, oh, she's going to betray Rose Walker. She's not who she appears to be. And I'm not blaming the actress at all, but more like the way that character was used, it just seemed like she was practically not in the series. Yes. And then she was also very important. It was really
there
bizarre.
Was kind of something missing in terms of like, why are you here?
I think that's partly because of future comic developments that, you know, if they're going to get their full, whatever seasons, they needed her established.
Early. And there is a thing where, you know, the first half of the series is basically a comic to 45 minutes, an hour of TV. And the second half of the series is two comics per episode. And I think some stuff gets smashed together. I mean, there are things, you know, like Dream of a Thousand Cats and Calliope work very nicely as half an episode. But then there's other places where it's like, there's maybe too much going on here. And maybe you had to stretch things a little too quickly. I think it's hard because you suddenly have this, like, here's a bunch of stuff that's not about Dream. And are you in for that? Or are you going to be like, where's Dream? Why isn't Dream in this episode? Listeners want to write in to know why isn't everyone asking where Dream is. That is challenging. Yeah.
I think that brings me to where I'm really interested to see how this show develops, if it's allowed to develop, is we're never going to have a season 8 of Game of Thrones situation here.
Doesn't seem like it. Not on Netflix. Yeah. I don't think this Netflix allows that.
They are not going to strike out their own territory, it seems like, that Neil Gaiman is an executive producer here. He has a very, very sweet deal with DC Comics in that, although he doesn't own the Sandman, DC would be burning astonishing amounts of bridges if DC didn't allow Neil Gaiman to essentially control this.
It is amazing what a person who has no legal claim to this has managed to stake out. I mean, good for him, I guess.
In a world
where, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I guess he's shown that he's willing to grim trigger them in a way that nobody else is, and he has enough money that he's not beholden to them. But
I don't know.
It is in a world where everybody else is like, yeah, Marvel gave me a few thousand dollars to not say anything bad about them.
Where I'm going with that is that I have every confidence that this is going to hew very closely to the comics all the way down to the end. This miniseries makes adjustments to, in some ways, very much improve on the comics. You know, I think that it is very much a story for 2022 and the comics were of their time. But will it be able to veer significantly in the future if the story needs to? I don't think so. I think we are going to get the Sandman story of the comics for the run. I may be surprised. And whether that 75 issue outline/bible serves the story well going forward for television, I don't think it's entirely assured. You've got fealty to the source material and respect for the creator, and you've got some outstanding actors and a writer's room that I did remarkable work with this season. But I just don't think that it's a given that it's going to be that great or that well regarded by general fantasy fans and Netflix subscribers. They've still got to do the work.
Other people, final thoughts, where they hope this goes next, what they'd like to see?
Are we going to do a second spoiler horn, perhaps?
I guess, yeah. I mean, I feel like we've done a lot of comics talk here already, but second spoiler horn for things that we know happen in the comics. Sarah, cover your ears.
I mean, in my mind, the next season is, I think, you know, they gave us Calliope, which means that gives us insight into Orpheus. Mm-hmm. And that whole plot with the Furies is also the whole Lucifer. I mean, I was really intrigued because they've set up Lucifer to be much more active in hell than in the comics, like much more invested in it as opposed to the, you know, the ennui kind of Lucifer in the comics.
And some of the ennui Lucifer in the comics, the being one of the three rulers of hell was Sandman inheriting God, hell continuity from other DC
hell
comics.
Continuity.
That was like in continuity.
As I will
with,
refer to my remark 30
yeah,
minutes before.
That was in to like to maintain consistencies with things they had shown about hell. I believe right. in Swamp Thing comics. God help me.
Oh my God.
So
that has to be, that'll be a season, I would think. Although it doesn't tie in directly with the Lucifer TV series, so I don't think it's really in conflict. There's an overlap. But I think that was a huge arc when you get all the other gods show up and you have this sort of various battles and political machinations about who gets the key to hell and so forth. And I think that could be good. That could be a good season too.
Mm-hmm. Everyone loves angels that are jerks. It's true.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the Vertigo brand right there.
It is. Yeah.
I mean, we've already done half of Dream Country, which is volume 3, which is the Calliope and Dream of a Thousand Cats. I'd love to see a version of Midsummer Night's
yes,
Dream. That is a fantastic story.
Episode 22, please.
Yeah, but that is like it does not really affect anything else in the story. There is the fourth story in that volume too, which I honestly was reading the summary. I was like, I don't even remember that one. But Season of Mist, which is the Hell series
that's really good.
Glenn was reflecting on. I think that's like the first arc that really got me into Sandman. I feel like, you know, I liked a lot of the stuff, but that one to me is the one that like clicked for me the most. So like that, it does feel like they could do an interesting job of like, hey, we've got these sort of season arcs. Maybe we can like package some of the standalone stories as specials, or like, I'd love to see them do almost like the Doctor Who approach, right? Where you do like off season, right? Like, oh, 6 months from now, there's a couple episodes that you can watch that are kind of standalone. Doesn't really matter.
Oh,
as
man,
like TV movies.
Yeah.
I mean,
something.
There's the whole World's End bit, which, you know, Dream pops up here and there, but it's all about these people trapped in this reality storm in the inn at the end of the world, and they just entertain themselves by telling stories, and the stories involve different references to the Ark. I want to see that. I mean, there's some good stuff in there.
That's season 5, right? The Death of Dream is the last season they do, and then the Rebirth.
Spoilers. So.
And I also
fire off a third spoiler horn.
We're in the comics now. But,
I know.
I also want to see. Honestly, my favorite is Brief Lives when Dream and
Delirium.
Delirium
to me is,
and we meet Destruction.
Oh, that's a whole wonderful arc.
And I can't wait to see who if this happens, who do they find to play Delirium and to play Destruction?
Luna Lovegood, the actress who played that role, just cast her.
Oh my goodness, that might be good. But it also takes us to the point of, you know, what this is, the entire Sandman major arc is a giant tragedy in the fact that Dream ultimately cannot change enough and has to end himself and become a new incarnation of himself, which is where Lyta's baby comes in, which is why they had to seed that. But, you know, they've already had, you know, the Dream's character, you know, he's already changing so much. I'm wondering how the heck are they going to manage to, if they carry through that arc, how are they going to corner him to the point where he does have to make that decision?
He has to fall in love again, and I don't know if they'll do it. I remember in the main arc, in like the current time frame in the comic books, I don't think he falls in love again. I think all the love affairs are in the past, and
there's
he's paying
one.
The consequences.
No, there's the one. There's the one.
Who's the one? The moon goddess or moon or priestess? But that's even that happens before we get a flashback
kind of
to it. I think right,
and it's pretty much off screen. Like they meet, and then there's a reference of her leaving him.
Okay.
And which triggers the Brief Lives arc.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. I'm willing to give Neil Gaiman the chance to hopefully adapt things in some interesting ways. I think I appreciate that.
Are you telling me that you think Neil Gaiman is an accomplished writer, Tony?
I'm telling you that I am glad that I'm glad that American Gods and Good Omens came first. Yeah. Cause those,
I like that Tony says it's like he's an executive at Netflix who is ready to put the money over.
Oh, yeah,
Tony,
Good
you
Omens
have a few million dollars for Neil Gaiman,
I just,
is what you're saying?
I will say I watched all of American Gods. It's a little rocky and it got canceled before it got to end. That's sad. So I'm glad that that is.
And that was a book.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that that got filed away before this got attempted. So, yeah, you know, sorry.
Yeah, as someone that has, like, again, not seen the comics, I want to see Lucifer in the next season. I want to see what Desire has planned. Yeah, but in addition to that, I want to see more of the siblings. I want to see the sibling interaction because I loved how much the deaths and dreams interactions were. The connection between Desire and Dream was just. What I got just left me wanting more. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, without knowing the stories, of course. So, like, yeah, grain of salt and all that kind of stuff. That's what I want. I want to see the Lucifer attempting to usurp the Endless, or at least Dream, but as an overarching thing where we discover and learn more about the other Endless. And so, yeah.
Sarah, I will tell you, after you read all of The Sandman, that's only 75 issues to plow through, there's a variety of spinoffs to The Sandman, but I will say one that I actually really like is there is a Lucifer spinoff, which I think is what the Netflix show was very, very, very,
that's
very loosely inspired by.
Mike Carey one, but, right?
Yeah, Mike Carey's Lucifer series, which is basically like... I've retired to Los Angeles. Ugh, heaven and hell are still annoyed at me. Like, now I have to deal with, you know, like, immortal politics forever. Are really enjoyable. I like them. And I think that was one of those things where I think the show is relatively popular, but I was one of those, like, this isn't what that comics was. I'm an obnoxious jerk and I don't like it.
It was the Hawkeye series of Sandman. It was good, though. I really liked it.
It was, the TV series for, Lucifer, it's like, it's very different.
Yes.
The first half is police procedural, and that's what it like.
Which offends me.
Yeah, which is
Tony. It's a good show. It's worth a watch.
It's very fun.
I'd say the latter third of it is getting more into the metaphysical.
Mm-hmm. Neil Gaiman has a cameo in one episode.
Wait, who does?
Yeah.
Neil Gaiman.
Oh my!
Yeah,
he does a voiceover for one episode that's like set in an alternate history. He's like the narrator.
Oh,
and that version of Lucifer had a cameo in
Legends of Tomorrow.
Legends of Tomorrow. Okay, yeah. So
Overture is good too. It's a many years later addition to Sandman lore, and I think it actually works really well as a very complete story with a lot of the things that are best about the main series, but without having with big stakes.
Anything else people want to say or hope that they will see in future Sandmans other than we hope there's a second season?
Yes, please. Netflix. Get off
your
butt.
Come on, Netflix.
Renew it.
Yeah, do you? Netflix, for crying out loud.
Don't be a jerk, Netflix. Nobody likes you. I mean, everybody likes you. Sorry.
The algorithm shows us that being a jerk is very profitable. All right, let us close out our story then. It was great to talk about this show and about comics with such a lovely collection of nerds. Panel, thank you all for being here. Chip Sutterth, thank you for being Chip Sutterth.
Thank you, not Chip.
Dan Morin, thanks for being here.
I'm going to go back to sleep now.
Sarah, sorry that we woke you up so early.
A perchance to dream, yes. Mm. Yeah, no, if I was to awake, am I awake? I don't know. This is a great dream to participate with all of you. And
Glenn Fleischman, I'd be worried the podcast would be successful if I didn't include you. Thanks as always.
I'm happy to oblige. I'll go back to writing love letters to Chip Sutterth.
Mm.
In the past.
last but certainly not least, Shannon Sutterth. Shannon, I'll just mention, you were ahead of me in watching the show, and so I would always be like, oh, there's a Slack thread I can't read yet, because I haven't seen the episode where Shannon's talking about the episode. And then I would watch the episode, and then I'd go digging back and find the thread. And so it was lovely to have you here as well for the
happy
the
to
real
be your guide.
The
happy
real time
to be your guide.
Slack
happy
discussion.
Happy to be here, and may everyone have sweet dreams the next time you sleep.
Incomparable listeners, thank you for listening. Sweet dreams. Goodbye, nerds.